A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. 2 years ago, Carmen Maria Machado pushed the weird and the gothic even further into the mainstream with her debut short story collection, Her Body and Other Parties, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and made her a Guggenheim Fellow. Her writing is in conversation with Shirley Jackson, Angela Carter, Kelly Link, and all the ghosts and ghouls with whom they were in conversation. And now, Machado is back with a haunted house of mirrors called In the Dream House, a memoir of a harrowing relationship told in the only way, Machado writes, she knew how. I broke the stories down because I was breaking down and didn't know what else to do. The list of chapters in the book reads like an introduction to Literary Tropes 101. Dream House as an exercise in point of view, Dream House as memory palace, as a stoner comedy, as word problem, as plot twist. Ultimately, it is, as one title puts it, an exercise in style, but one in which Machado considers all the territory surrounding the Dream House. Stereotypes about lesbian relationships, as safe or as hysterical, her religious adolescence, the insufficiency of the law, and the absence in the archives of stories that don't fit traditional demographics or even narratives of abuse. Carmen Maria Machado joins us in the studio to talk about her memoir, In the Dream House. Thanks so much for talking to me, Carmen.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So my first question is, I guess, the most obvious one, which is, what did it feel like to move from short stories to memoir? And I guess, what was that shift in vulnerability like? Do you feel like there was a shift in vulnerability?
Oh, definitely. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think the move from fiction, and I guess I wouldn't call it even a move because I feel like I'm now like returning to fiction. I'm like, I'm so sorry, baby. I didn't mean to stray. Like, I'm coming back, you know. It's just a one-time thing with the nonfiction. But yeah, definitely it is an entirely different animal. Even though like the things I'm writing about in my memoir are like a lot of things that I've written about in short fiction as well. But there's just something about knowing there's nowhere to hide, because theoretically, like, if, you know, if I wrote a short story that was fairly autobiographical and someone asked me about it, I could just be like, well, it's entirely fiction, so I don't really have anything to say about it, you know, in terms of its relationship to my life. But with nonfiction, you don't have that luxury. And so there is something very intense and very, yeah, very vulnerable about having a book like that in the world and, you know, not having that sheen of fiction or that protective sheath.
I wonder, too, whether, I mean, are you worried about people going back and reading the short stories in a different lens? Because there is some definitely thematic overlap, and even some of the images, like,
I mean,
the,
yeah,
the fridge.
Totally. Oh, yeah, it's inevitable. Yeah. I mean, I think, right, actually, somebody has asked me about the fridge. They were like, was the fridge from the Law and Order story, like, the fridge from the, and I was like, yeah, that was, yeah, and you can see that. And I think that's, like, interesting, but it just is sort of, you know, it's different to write like about yourself having sex and like also just about yourself like being in a place of like deep pain. I mean, that is like a really hard thing to experience and a really hard thing to write about. And it's very embarrassing. And so there's a lot of that emotion that I think comes along with it.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me wonder, you know, you talked about this sort of almost the veneer between the writer with fiction that doesn't really exist for nonfiction. And that makes me want to ask about the structure of In the Dream House. Because in a way, it feels like the structure obviously, like, you know, you're building it up and you're in a way creating some boundaries. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, those boundaries enable you to just explode in a lot of different directions.
Yeah. Well, I'm very interested in writing in which the organizing intelligence is palpable. Like, that's always been very interesting to me. And I think it's, for me, what makes something a piece of art. And because, you know, it isn't just enough to just, like, regurgitate the stuff that happened to you. Like, anybody could do that. But, like, trying to turn it sort of beautiful and interesting, and to make it make sense in a way that makes sense to you. And I think, you know, for some people it might seem unnecessary or distracting, and like, I don't pretend that like everybody's going to get it or understand it, but it did give me this like framework to like do what my brain was doing. Like, I think the problem was that for years I was trying to write the story in a direct way, in like a straightforward manner, and like, it's just simply, it doesn't exist that way in my head. And so it's really hard to write about that, write about it in that way. So like, once I got that structure figured out, like, I mean, the whole book just kind of fell out of me. I mean, like, it felt like, oh, I've like figured out the shape of this thing.
So how did you hit upon the structure? Because it seems so obvious reading mm-hmm. it, and the way that there's this neat stacking up of epigraphs, the overture, the prologue, almost like bricks with each of these chapters coming in with a different motif or metaphor or genre or way of looking at the dream house. Did you come up with like a list of all of the dream house as whatevers and then fill them in?
Yes and no. So for like the more sort of like memoir bits, like the bits that are just like, here, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, those I usually would like write them and then try to figure out like what sort of thing I could attach to it, if that makes sense. Because mm-hmm. I was just like, oh, I'm just writing down like what happened. Like, I want to make sure that this material is included in like this bit and this bit. But then they also, in the other direction, would sort of serve as these prompts for me. So, for example, Dream House is time travel. Like, that was one where I was like, I wonder, like, how was this, like, time travel? And it became sort of more of a way of thinking about metaphor and about the metaphor of time travel and, you know, ultimately the metaphor of the Novikov self-consistency principle, which is this idea in time travel, about how you can't change, basically you can't change the past. If time travel were actually possible, you couldn't, like, alter events that have already happened, which is sort of how I was beginning to think about the process of writing that book and the process of like coming up to this very old version of myself. So it sort of depended on what it was that I was, and, you know, and I also ended up like, there were a lot that I ended up combining. Like, there were a lot where my editor was like, you have two of these, they're sort of similar, they could be combined under a single header, and mm-hmm. you just got to like figure out a way to put them together. So like, you know, ultimately I ended up sort of fussing with it a lot. And I mean, even though I think the final version of the book has like, I think it's 141, if I remember correctly, or it might be a little more than that, but it's like around there somewhere. But I had hundreds written down, like so many.
I mean, I think one of the weirdest and most interesting ones is, I mean, this relates to what you're talking about with time travel, is the choose your own adventure chapter, mm-hmm. in which that did feel, that one felt really mean almost.
Yeah. Well, that idea, so that was actually really interesting. So early on in the process, I have somewhere in a notebook, I have written down, like, in the middle of all my notes, like, gaslight the reader, ? Like, underlined many times and like circled a whole bunch, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was constantly trying to figure out how to do it. Like, I was like, I want to sort of do something in the book that creates the effect of gaslighting. And at first I had this idea where I would like reference things that weren't real and do some other stuff. But I was always concerned that people would not understand what I was doing. Or that like, it would just seem like I had forgotten my own book, you know, as opposed to like a thing I was doing deliberately. And then at some point I was thinking about a choose your own adventure as a structure, which is a structure that other writers have used for various purposes. And I was really interested in thinking about how that could be done. And then I was like, you know, a choose your own adventure is actually a really appropriate, because, you know, there's this illusion of choice, right? But like, really, you have no choice at all. You have a choice to follow or not follow. You know, you're given two paths or maybe three. You can get stuck. You can go in circles. And so ultimately it became just like a very useful tool. And then once I started writing with you, like thinking, like, you know, being laying out that chapter and sort of imagining Yeah, like what would the experience be of the reader, like, encountering this chapter, including, like, the hidden bits? I don't know if you found.
Yes, I did. I did. I followed the rules. I didn't cheat. But then I went back
then
and
you
was
went
like,
back.
There's pages I missed here.
Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. And that's the thing that I completely 100% stole from. There's this writer, Kevin Brockmeyer, who I really love. And he has a really beautiful short story called The Human Soul is a Rube Goldberg Device that was in one of his collections. And that's Choose Your Own Adventure structure. And he also has a hidden page. I mean, it's to very different ends, but it's a really beautiful story. And I was really interested in that. And then I liked the idea of, like, yeah, like, scolding the reader for breaking the rules and just, like, sort of having, like, a generally hostile, like, a mean. Yeah, like, I think saying it feels mean is accurate. Like, sort of a hostile chapter that is not pleasant to encounter. It feels like a game until it's not a game anymore.
One of the reasons why it's funny to talk to you about the book now, I feel like you already did it. You already, like, talked about the book while I was reading the book.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And in a way, it felt to me a little bit like the way you would anticipate sort of arguments from someone about the relationship itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, it's not battery. Sometimes relationships are just rough. Was the way the structure sort of turns on itself and criticizes itself related to that, do you think?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of those criticisms, it was self-criticism, but also it was like things people said to me or like things that concerned me. So I guess it was both from other people and from the self. But yeah, I wanted the book to anticipate people's concerns as best as possible. And I recognize that, like, that's only, like, there are limits to that. Like, I'm sure there are 10 million criticisms of the book that people have come up with already that I haven't even thought of. And, like, that's fine, because that's what it means to write a book, right? Is you're having your half of the conversation. And then, like, all the people who read the book get to have their half of the conversation, but you don't have to necessarily participate. Because you already did your thing.
Uh-huh. Well, the other reason the memoir kind of feels like a conversation to me is the literal aspect of the first person speaking to the second. And sometimes vice versa, because the narrative is split, roughly speaking, into passages told by either the first or the second person.
Mm-hmm.
But the divide isn't always so clean. Originally, I was like, I thought I figured it out. I was like, great. Okay. So we've got the past. We've got the present. We have this wise person looking back and, you know, speaking to the you of the past. But then, you know, there's some slippages. And I'm really interested in those slippages, mm-hmm. and sort of how that perspective shift arose for you.
Yeah. So initially, when I had written the first draft of the book, I had written mostly just the memoir part, so there wasn't all the sort of analysis and essays and research, like, that didn't really exist. And I had written the whole thing in second person, and my editor was sort of like, we need to talk about that at some point. Because it's not that you can't do it, it's just that, you know, I want to make sure you're being purposeful about it. You're not sort of using it just as, like, a distancing technique because you're feeling so trauma. You know, we need to talk mm-hmm. about that. And I was like, sure, no problem. So when I finally went back to the book, I was like, I can just put it in first. And I began to, like, try to transition all the pieces into first. And I was actually really struggling because they weren't hitting my ear right. Like, when I read them out loud, I was like, this doesn't feel correct. Like, the text was sort of resisting me. And so then I was thinking a lot about this novel that I love, which is We the Animals by Justin Torres, which is a novel that involves, like, a plural first voice, which is then shattered by an act of trauma and then becomes, like, split into, like, third and second and first and all this stuff. And so I was just like, well, I could just do that and have, yeah, this, like, I sort of confronting the you, which is, like, this past, you know, the you is, like, the past Carmen who's, like, on this continual hamster wheel of pain and is just sort of, like, running through these bits over and over and over again. And the I is, like, having a dialogue with her, or not a dialogue, but, like, a monologue towards her, mm-hmm. Because she can't listen, because she can't answer back, you know. And so, yeah, and then there are a few moments where I let the you bleed through the I.
I think one of the other things that made reading the book, which could have been a really isolating and lonely experience for me as a reader, and I can't imagine what it was like for you as a writer, was all the references, especially the ones looking outward to other works of art or historical or legal records of relationships that were just that tiny little bit like yours. Although the difficulty that you had in finding them really speaks to this archival silence, this absence that you talk about. And I think it turns the memoir into this quasi-genre that a lot of other writers have straddled, like Maggie Nelson,
sure,
for instance.
Sure.
So what kinds of texts were you reaching for as you were writing, and what was the intended effect?
Yeah, well, Maggie Nelson is a big influence for me. I really love her work. I had a lot of anxiety writing this book because I am not a historian. I'm not an academic. I did not study English. I do not have a PhD. Like, I was, even from the beginning, thinking the research stuff part of it would be me very much like stretching my, like leaving my comfort zone and like sort of stretching myself mm-hmm. beyond my normal capacity, which was like really interesting. So like, you know, I found myself just like neck deep in, like, I did some research stuff at the Lesbian Herstory Archives in New York. I did a lot of like legal, like I was really interested in, like, came very interested in like the legal papers that were sort of written around this topic, which were fascinating. Also like the sort of wealth of, like, you know, queer and feminist periodicals that sort of traced a lot of this dialogue and would occasionally have like issues sort of dedicated to this topic, the topic of like queer domestic violence. And like other stuff that other writers had written. There wasn't a ton, but there was some. You know, I watched a lot of documentaries. I watched, you know, I read a lot of, but the problem is that a lot of it hadn't been organized. So I think I was feeling very, especially out of my comfort zone, because I was like, they should have, I feel like it's like that scene in the movie Contact where Jodie Foster's like, they should have sent a poet. I'm like, they should have sent a historian. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm really out of my comfort zone here. But it was just like a lot of different sources that I was pulling together. And then ultimately, I mean, at the end of the book, I wrote that sort of little afterword where I was like, okay, like, I did the best I could. Here's all the stuff that I looked at. Please, someone else do it, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think knowing that there is an archive of some kind, even if it's not organized, can make you feel not alone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because one of the things that really spoke to me was Dreamhouse's epiphany, which is just one sentence: most forms of abuse are completely legal. And that, of course, goes for all forms of abuse, but there is that special wrinkle for abuse that happens with and between people who weren't even recognized as being possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Victorians not even bothering to outlaw relations between women
right.
because lesbianism was unimaginable.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in the context of that, fudgy, not exactly illegal, but still bad, murky territory of just people being bad to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how does your story and how does queer abuse more broadly fit in?
Well, I think it's in a few ways. I mean, people get very fixated on legality as like a metric of badness, which I've always found very interesting because I'm like, you know, there's a lot. Okay, A, there's been a lot of human behavior that has been not morally wrong, that has been made illegal for all kinds of reasons. Alternately, there's a lot of human behavior that is not, like, bad human behavior that is not illegal and that is, you know, completely outside the framework of the law. And we know that the law is, like, insufficient for most things, right?
And really uneven.
Totally. Yeah. Unevenly applied.
Exactly.
You know, we're constantly sort of shifting our understanding of, like, what things should or should not be illegal. You know, the law is so insufficient in every way. And I'm just really, really interested in, like, the ways in which, like, the way it's okay to say, like, no, the thing that happened to me was not illegal, but also, like, it was bad, and it's okay for me to say, like, it was bad, it was not acceptable. I protest this. I think this also applies to not just, like, the question of, like, abuse, but also, like, Me Too, right? There's, like, a lot of stuff that's been described that's, like, super fucked up, right, and really bad, but also, like, not necessarily illegal and not necessarily, like, sexual harassment or rape or sexual assault. And, like, I think it's about acknowledging that, like, things can be very, very, very bad. They can be abusive without being illegal. And, like, those things are not at odds with each other. Like, it's just another sort of dimension of the experience. And I know, like, I've always known that the law fails most people most times. But doing this book really brought home how that applies to, like, this specific kind of violence.
And I think the law, too, can be such a crutch for people and something that you want to lean on because there are punishments laid out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You have sort of statutes for, like, just how wrong something
right.
is. And that can be really, not comforting exactly, but it gives you some kind of metric.
Sure.
And it's in the way that, you know, you're sort of inventing a form and a language to talk about queer intimate abuse in the same way that, like, in the murky areas of Me Too, we're trying to imagine a way not just to talk about these gray areas, say, but also figure out what to do after.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if jail, if prison isn't the right answer,
right.
if losing your job isn't the right answer, what is? What does
right.
that look like?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I think that Me Too has really brought this into sharp focus mm-hmm. because, I mean, you can't put people in prison for, like, emotional abuse or, like, verbal abuse, mm-hmm. you know? I do think there's something really important to me about just being, like, it's okay to simply, like, be able to just say, like, this is a bad thing that has happened to me. I need people to acknowledge it. And I need it to, there to be something, us to think about what to do about this situation, whatever that looks like. And again, like, that's not perfect and it's not easy, but I don't know. I don't know the answers, you know, like I don't know what to do necessarily, but I just needed to say, like, this is what happened to me. And here are the ways in which the response to it was insufficient.
There are links in the show notes for you to find Carmen Maria Machado's book, In the Dream House, as well as links to some of the things we talked about, like Kevin Brockmeyer's Choose Your Own Adventure stories, the original movie Gaslight that gave birth to the ever-popular expression, and a few of the essays that Carmen cites in her afterword. We'll be back next week. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.